So we turn now in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 33. Going back to the 31st chapter, verse 3, as sort of a background to 33, "Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you.'" So he has the word of God and the promise of God that he steps out on. God is saying, go back to your family, go back to your land, I will be with you. Now, as he is on his way back, he sends his servants ahead to tell his brother Esau, who had vowed to kill him, that he is coming home, that God has blessed him, that he has an abundance, evidently seeking to indicate to Esau, I'm not coming back to claim my birthright. I have plenty of my own. I'm not looking for anything of the family for sustenance or support. And the servants returned with the message that his brother was coming to meet him with 400 armed men. Now, he recognized that that wasn't a necessary kind of a welcoming committee, and he was fearful. And so he prayed in verse 9 of chapter 32, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you.'" Lord, you asked me to come back. You said you'd be good. Now here comes Esau, 400 men. I'm not worthy, the least of all the mercies and of all of the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." So news of his brothers coming to meet him struck fear in his heart. He prayed again and reminded God that you told me to come home, that you would deal well with me, and you told me also that my descendants would be as the sand of the sea. I am afraid of Esau. So the Lord directed Jacob, perhaps, or perhaps Jacob did it on his own scheming, to restore the relationship that he had with Esau. And he did it, first of all, by sending out these droves of animals, blessing his brother with these gifts, building up his brother, speaking of him as Lord and himself as his brother's servant. Having shared with his brother the bounty and the blessing that God had bestowed upon him while he was at Paddan Aram. And so we find that in chapter 33, the showdown, Jacob lifted up his eyes and he looked, and there was Esau coming toward him, and 400 men. So he put each of the children with their mothers, the children of Leah with her, with the maidservants, their children, and Rachel and Joseph. And he put the maidservants and their children in the front, and then Leah and her children behind them, and last of all, Rachel and Joseph. And then he went out in front of them. And as he went towards his brother, he bowed to the earth seven times. Now, according to the Tell on Amarna tablets, which are a famous archaeological discovery that deals with some of the laws and customs of that time, when you approached a king, you were to bow seven times. So his bowing seven times is sort of a traditional, customary thing in approaching a king. And in this, he was really acknowledging Esau's lordship over him. He was not trying to come as a lord over Esau, but bowed to him seven times. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Now I imagine at this point there was a lot of sharing. Jacob had been gone for 20 years, and when he had left, his father was almost dead. He probably asked about his dad, found out he was still alive, but at this point was probably totally incapacitated. However, his father did go on living for another 17 years. His mother, Rebekah, had already died, and I imagine that Esau was just sort of filling him in on all of the things that transpired while he was gone. And then Esau lifted up his eyes and he saw the women and the children, and he said, "Who are these that are with you?" And he said, "These are the children whom God has graciously given to your servant." Now Esau in the meantime had also had a large family, several children. And in fact, in your reading next week, you're going to come across the names of the family of Esau in chapter 36. And the reason why we're taking three chapters next week is you can skip chapter 36 because it just has a lot of names of the descendants of Esau that mean nothing to us. And so you can skip over chapter 36 next week, and that's why we're taking three chapters, 35 through 37 next week. So he saw all of the children, and no doubt at a signal from Jacob, the maidservants came near and their children, and they bowed down. Leah also came near with her children, they bowed down, and afterward Joseph and Rachel came near and they bowed down. Then Esau said, "What do you mean by all of this company which I met?" And he said, "These are to find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And Jacob said, "No, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have enough." So Esau, first of all, questions the people. "They're my children." Then he questions all of these servants that he had met earlier with all of the animals. And Jacob said, "These are my present." And Esau said, "I don't need them. I have enough." Now, Jacob later said, "I had enough" in verse 11. But in the Hebrew, there are two different Hebrew words used here, both of them translated "enough." When Esau said, "I have enough," it is the Hebrew word rab, R-A-B, which means "I have much." When, in a few verses, verse 11, Jacob said, "I have enough," he said, "I have coal, I have everything." So Esau said, I've got much, and he said, "Well, I've got everything." You see, Jacob had learned that God was his resource. And when God becomes your resource, you have everything. You may have a lot, but you don't have as much as the man who has God. The man who has God has everything. He has God as his resource, and thus there is that total sufficiency that is ours through him. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let's go, and we will go before you." But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and the herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all of the flock would die. So please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant, and I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir." So it would seem that Jacob is perhaps still a little leery. He's not really quite sure. He asked his brother, "Look, if you've really forgiven me and all, then take this as the sign, all of these flocks and all as the sign. Please take them from me as the sign that you have forgiven me." And when Esau says, "Come on, let's go together," you know, and he says, "Well, I would rather not." In other words, he's seeking to separate immediately. "I've met him. There is a peaceful meeting. I'm satisfied with that. Now you go on back, and I'll come along at a pace that the children and the animals can handle." Now, he had been driving them hard up to this point because he had been fleeing from Laban. And during the time that they were fleeing from Laban, they were really driving hard. No doubt the pace slowed down once they had left Laban. And now he's going to really slow down the pace. And he said, "I'll come and, you know, just we'll meet you there in Seir as soon as we were able to get there," driving at a slower pace. And Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and he built himself a house, and he made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Now, it is interesting, and I don't know, and you can't really tell from the text, whether or not Jacob was just, again, deceiving his brother, saying, "Go on back, and I'll come back and meet you. You know, I'll come at my pace." He evidently had no intentions of going all the way back to Seir. As soon as he came there to Succoth, he built a house. And he built booths for the cattle. In other words, you don't build a house unless you just plan to settle down for a while. And evidently, Jacob did settle down in Succoth for several years. Just how many years, of course, we do not know. At the time that he met Esau, the oldest of his children, Reuben, was probably only 12 years old at the most at the time that he met Esau. When they left Succoth and came to Shechem, it was at Shechem that the daughter Dinah was raped by the prince of Shechem, and her older brothers got revenge against the people of Shechem for this act against their sister. So they had to be probably in their 20s at that time. So it is possible that they stayed here at Succoth for as much as 8 years. Now, Succoth was still on the other side of Jordan. They had not yet come back into the land that had been promised to Abraham. It's a great place for grazing, and so having all of the animals that they did, they probably just remained there for a while. They built a house, they built booths for the cattle, and stayed there for quite a period of time. And then they continued their journey now into the land, crossing Jordan and coming into Canaan. So Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought there a parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of silver. And then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohi Israel, God the God of Israel. So he now finally comes on into the land. It is possible that during this 8 years or so that he was in Succoth, that he journeyed down and visited Esau and visited his aged father. But nothing is really told to us of this particular period of time that he remained in Succoth. When he came to Shechem, he not only bought the parcel of land there, but he also dug a well. And this well that Jacob dug at Shechem is the well where Jesus met that woman of Samaria who came out to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." And she said, "Why do you ask me for a drink? You're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan. We don't have dealings with each other." And Jesus said, "Woman, if you knew who it was that was asking you for a drink, you would have asked him for a drink." And she said, "No way." She said, "That well is deep. You don't have anything to draw with." And he said, "But if you drink of this water, you're going to thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I give, you'll never thirst again. It's like a well of running water just springing up within your soul." She said, "All right, I'll take some of that so I don't have to come out here every day." He said, "Well, go call your husband." "I don't have any husband." Jesus said, "Okay. You've had five, and the man you're living with, you never did marry him. All right, I accept it. You don't have a husband." She said, "Sir, I perceive you're a prophet." Now, she was at Jacob's well, drawing water. Today, outside of the ruins of the ancient city of Shechem, that well is still there. The water level is still low. It takes a long rope to get your can down into the water of the well there. Jacob's well. So the well that Jacob dug in Shechem. Shechem is at the foot of Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. It is in a valley. It is not far from the ancient capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, which is Samaria. Later on, when Joshua came into the land, the people were to stand in the area near Shechem there while men went up on the top of Mount Ebal and others went up on the top of Mount Gerizim. And those on Mount Ebal would call down the blessings of keeping the law, and those on on Mount Ebal called down the curses if they failed to keep the law, and those on Mount Gerizim called down the blessings on those who kept the law. The Samaritans maintain that it was on Mount Gerizim that God gave the law to Moses. And there are to the present day a remnant of Samaritans who annually at Passover time offer as a sacrifice live sheep on the top of Mount Gerizim. However, these Samaritans are reduced in number. There are only about 200 Samaritans left in the world today. And they are pretty much imbecilic because they are so much inbreeding. They only marry Samaritans, and because of all of the inbreeding, they're pretty much imbecilic now. About 200 of them left and still sacrificing on Mount Gerizim. You remember that when Jesus confronted this gal, She said, our fathers say we're to worship God on this mountain, Mount Gerizim. You say in Jerusalem, where should God be worshipped? And Jesus said, neither in this mountain nor Jerusalem. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. So all of this in the area where Jacob came, pitched his tent there, bought a parcel of land from Hamor there outside of the city of Shechem, not far outside. It's only about 500 feet or so from Jacob's well to the site of the ancient city of Shechem. And so chapter 34 then has its scenery, this area there near Shechem. He erected the altar and called it God, the God of Israel. This is the first time that Jacob uses the new name that God gave to him. But you see, he has now come back into the land. God said, return to the land. He was hesitant in coming back. He stopped for several years at Succoth. But now he has come into the land. Now, in reality, he is still not totally obedient to God. Because if you will remember, God said, return to the land and to your family. His family is still several miles south. 70 or 80 miles south in the area of Beersheba, and of course Esau down in the area of Mount Seir, but his father in the area of Hebron. So he was disobedient to God in staying there at Shechem. And that disobedience became costly. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Now, the 11 older brothers probably had enough companionship among themselves. They did, you know, fine. They had each other to buddy around with. But Dinah, being the only girl, went out to find some playmates, really, among the daughters of those of Shechem, from Shechem, the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. Now, it is, of course, impossible for us to know anything about the nature or the character of Dinah, whether or not she had any part of this. It could be that she was in rebellion against her parents, against the strict rules of separation that they had talked to her about. A lot of speculation, all of it worthless. Unless the scripture says it, it's only speculation. And so all we know from the scriptures that he lay with her and violated her. And his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman, and he spoke kindly to the young woman. And so he found himself drawn to her, speaking tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, I want you to get me this gal as my wife. Marriage in those days was by arrangement, and it was always involved with a dowry. And so Shechem is asking his father, who is more or less the king over this area, to get this young girl for his wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with the livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. From the story, it would seem that Dinah remained at the house of Hamor. Jacob realized that he was not able, without his sons, to do much about it. He was outnumbered by the people of the city, and sort of helplessly caught in a position here. And so he waited till his sons came home, and then he shared to them what had happened to their sister Dinah. And then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, that is the brothers, and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. They had a great concern for the promises of God and for the line from which the promises were to come. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife, and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. And so shall you dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it, and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." Then Shechem said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give." So here the dad and the son are seeking now to strike sort of a bargain with Jacob. Let's just intermarry. Let's just mix together. And they're asking for a mixture of the peoples. You marry our daughters, we'll marry your daughters, and just sort of we'll absorb you. And you can just become a part of our society here. You can gain possessions and all, you can just live with us, and you can just join with us, and we'll just be melted in together. Of course, this would have completely frustrated the plan of God in bringing the Messiah into the world. Shechem is so in love with Dinah. He said, "Ask whatever you want, I'll give it to you. Ask me ever so much dowry." However much you want to ask as far as dowry, the bride price, "and a gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the woman as a wife." But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people." So we'll become one with you on this condition, that all of the males are circumcised, that you become as we are. Now, they did this deceitfully, as it declares, and as we will see. "But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we'll be gone." And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all of the household of his father. He was so anxious to marry her, he submitted to the rite of circumcision immediately. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of the city, and they spoke with the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. But will not their livestock and their property and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. So they are selling the men of the city now on this prospect, and all who went out of the gate of the city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, who were Dinah's brothers, full brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword. And they took Dinah from Shechem's house and they went out. Then the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and they plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. And they took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, and what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, they took captive and they plundered even all that was in the houses. So they looted the whole place, took the women and children for slaves. And then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, and I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" So Jacob indicates really a weakness of character here in dealing with his sons. What they have done is not excusable. But it should be noted that the whole issue arose because of Jacob's disobedience. It is so often that one step of disobedience compounds into a major kind of an issue. We step out of God's will. We start to do our own thing. And we may rationalize it. We may say, "Well, we're back in the land, and God said go back to the family, but we go and visit them occasionally, and we're back in the land here." But it was not a complete obedience. They were not walking in the will of God, and as a result, this whole thing flared up. So true in your own life, that incomplete obedience, that failure to fully submit your life to the will and the plan of God can lead to such disasters. It can bring you all kinds of problems. You will find yourself embroiled in situations of which you wonder, "How did I ever get in this mess?" It all began with a moving away from the center of God's plan and will for your life. It began with an incomplete obedience to what God had commanded of you. There are places where you and I as a child of God have no business being. And if you go into those places, you are stepping out of the purpose and the plan of God for your life, and you can find yourself embroiled and enmeshed in all kinds of tragic situations just because you're where God wouldn't want you to be. Look at all of the trouble that Samson brought upon himself every time he ventured into the land of the Philistines, went to the camp of the enemy. He always ended up in trouble. It finally ended up in his own death. And you may think, "Well, I'm strong enough. I just go to watch. I don't participate. But I just like to see what they do. When I was in seminary, we had a bunch of guys that used to, in seminary, say, well, we got to know what we're preaching against. So let's go down and watch the Follies on Main Street, you know. And I said, no way. We have no business being in those kind of places. Well, what do you know what you're preaching against? You know, unless you go down and see it firsthand, and then, you know, you'll know what you're really talking about. Kind of rationale. Doesn't work. Because the moment you step into the enemy's territory, the moment you step out of the will of God, the moment you are disobedient, you're opening the door, and you can be sure that you're going to be facing some major crises and major problems. And here Jacob stepped out of the will of God. God said, go back to your family. He stopped and bought land in Shechem and planned to settle down there. That incomplete obedience brought to him now a parcel of trouble as his sons did this despicable thing in destroying all of the males who had sincerely entered into a covenant which should never have been in the first place. Actually, the requirement that they made of them was almost blasphemous. This was to be a sacred mark between God's people and himself. And here they're requiring these ungodly people to take this sacred mark of consecration to God, and they knew nothing of consecration to God. So they were taking the sacred things and treating them blasphemously, and then added on top of that the murder of the men and the captivating of the women and the children. Jacob was upset. Not only that, he was worried. The inhabitants of the land are much greater than we are. They're going to hear what you've done, and they're going to attack us and wipe us out. But they answered him, only should they treat our sister like a harlot. Jacob didn't have any answer for them. Now, this act of the sons, Simeon and Levi, is not dealt with immediately. Jacob just sort of passes over it. He doesn't say anything more at this time. But when it comes to the end of the road, and Jacob is on his deathbed, and he is now going around the room pronouncing upon his sons the patriarchal blessing, this deed of Simeon and Levi is not forgotten. In chapter 49, verse 5, as he sits on his bed just before he dies, musters all of the strength that he can to sit up on the edge of the bed, looks around the room at these 12 sons now grown with their own families, pronouncing upon them the prophecies of the future. When he gets to Simeon and Levi, verse 5, he said, they are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. Let not my soul enter into their counsel. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so he does not really give any blessing to Simeon and Levi, but curses their anger and their actions. Jacob knows he has to move. He has created an abomination among the people. He was obnoxious now to them, and he's got to move on. So in chapter 35, we find God saying to Jacob, "Arise and go to Bethel and dwell there." And next Sunday, we'll get into the return to Bethel and what it means. May the Lord help us to learn the lessons that are in these stories. The lesson of restoring a bad relationship. For surely Jacob's relationship with his brother Esau was bad. His brother hated him, vowed to kill him. But Jacob blessed his brother. He built up, he edified his brother. He shared with his brother. He touched his brother, embraced, kissed. And that love that had been dead was rekindled. And those are the keys to rekindling a dead love. Jesus said, change. You've left your first love. Change. Do your first works over. And the way to restore a lost love relationship is actually by going back and doing the first works over. Change from your present coldness and aloofness. Begin to give to that one that you love who has lost their love for you. Build them up. Share with them openly. Touch them. God can restore those bad relationships. The second major lesson to learn is obey God completely. Don't park where you ought not to be. Stay out of the enemy's camp. Let your obedience to God's purpose and plan be complete. Don't stay at Shechem and settle down in Shechem when God has called you to go all the way back to your family in Hebron. Be obedient unto God. Be fully committed to Him. You'll save yourself an awful lot of trouble. And may the Lord be with you and help you now this week. As you walk with Him, may His love and His Spirit sustain you. And may you in turn find a renewed relationship with Him as God works in your life, bringing you to that total commitment of your all to Him and to the things of the Spirit. In Jesus' name.